The views and opinions of the host, guests, and callers of Radio Free ARFCOM do not necessarily reflect those of AR15.com, BBS Radio, or their advertisers. When any techniques, skills, or theories are presented, they reflect the practices and opinions of the individual presenting them, but not necessarily those of Radio Free ARFCOM, AR15.com, or BBS Radio. In all circumstances, Radio Free ARFCOM, AR15.com, and BBS Radio expressly disclaim any liability that may result in the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begin.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Here we go.
Let's go.
All this stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the sting of battle.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
Radio Free ARFCOM starts now.
And welcome all my fellow ARFCOMers across the globe and around the United States. It is now show number 12 of Radio Free ARFCOM. That's right, we've been doing it for 3 months now, and we're still going strong. We haven't got pulled off the air yet, so we must be doing something right. Another great show lined up for you today. We're going to start off with Joe DeBurgolis, as usual, get the show kicked off the right way. After him, we have a representative. Usually we have Phil Schreier come in from the National Rifle Association Museum. This week it's going to be Matt Sharp, another employee there. He's going to come and talk about a couple of really cool pieces they have there. Mel Gibson's M16 from We Were Soldiers, and a couple of pieces from the Wild Bunch movie. I'm sure some of you guys remember that. And then following that, a get-to-know, a really cool extended get-to-know, with Jarhead22, one of our well-known ARFCOM members. This guy has some really cool, interesting stories to tell about what he does for a living. I think you guys will be very interested in that. And then following him, just after the top of the hour, we're going to have Daniel Miller on. He's the president of the Texas Nationalist Movement. They are the big Texas secession group that has kind of just really blossomed over the last year or so. Gee, I wonder why. In Texas. He's going to be on to talk all things Texas secession with us. So we got a great show lined up. Pour yourself your favorite drink. Kick back. Log on to AR15.com. You can follow the show in the threads. There's a thread in GD, and there's a discussion thread in the Radio Free ARFCOM section. Lots of good discussions going on in GD tonight. So check those out as well. If you have any questions throughout the course of the night for anybody on the show, you can either IM me on AR15.com. If you're a member of the Radio Free ARFCOM group, go ahead and just post your question up on the Radio Free ARFCOM group site there on Facebook, and I will get your question on the air as fast as possible. Or you can email me at radiofreearfcom.gmail or radiofreearfcom@gmail.com. Without any further ado, I want to welcome Joe DeBurgolis to the show. Joe, how are you today?
Good, John. How are you?
Doing outstanding. It's always good to hear your voice on a Monday evening. It means that we've made it to another show, and we're still on the air.
Congratulations, 12 weeks and going. It's who would have thought?
Yeah, I was seriously thought we were going to get canned after the first show, so it's good to know 3 months later we're still here going strong. Let's get right to some NRA news, some gun rights news. I was on NRAILA.org this week checking out a couple of their stories, and there is a big Second Amendment march that the NRA is helping endorse coming up. When is it? April 19th of this month?
April 19th, down in Washington, actually on the grounds of the Washington Monument. The good folks of the Second Amendment March are getting together to voice our collective opinion of how the Second Amendment should be treated in this country. The people organizing it have put together a great array of speakers, and you got some very solid support from some of the great gun groups out there as well.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be actually pretty big. I didn't think it was going to be as big as it is. Now, just to remind everyone, this is not the armed march that's happening in Virginia. This is just a Second Amendment rally. Are there going to be people wearing holsters, empty holsters or anything like that, Joe? Do you know?
Best of my knowledge, they're trying to discourage that just due to the park regulations out there. The organizers have put on their website, SecondAmendmentMarch.org, a listing of what they hopefully expect the participants to carry forth. This is not armed, as you mentioned, but you can be as vocal as you like. We expect you to be as polite as possible. If you're approached by law enforcement, park rangers, what have you, show them the courtesy. It should be very well attended, as you mentioned, John. And I think it's going to be something where our issues are going to be brought to the forefront, and it's going to be something that the media is really going to grab hold on to. So I encourage everyone who's in the area, those traveling from outside, thank you for your support. It's going to be something to really set the tone for the rest of the 2010 election year.
So if you have a chance, everybody, that's April 19th here in just in a little over a week and a half, it looks like. If you get the chance, please attend this. If you're anywhere in the D.C. area, please attend it. It's going to paint gun owners in a very positive light. This is going to be one of those protests where we can really show that gun owners are responsible, that we're articulate, we're well-spoken, but we do care about our rights. The other thing I wanted to talk with you about is I was looking on there. It looks like Chuck Norris is going to be in Charlotte this year.
He is. He's coming in. Chuck is, as many people know, is helping us with the trigger the vote. He's our chairman. And he has been advocating with the NRA for those people out there so inclined to get involved in the NRA, particularly register the vote, let your voice be heard. And he's been out there trying to lead the parade through his black belt patriotism. And Chuck's a great advocate of the Second Amendment. I happen to know him a little bit. He's a very, very down-to-earth, good person who wears his patriotism, obviously, on his sleeve.
And everybody on ARFCOM loves Chuck Norris for obvious reasons. I mean, it's Chuck Norris, guys. Come on. He's going to be there. We've already talked about a couple of weeks ago all the other celebrities are going to be there. I guess they have a big dinner auction on Friday night at the annual meetings. Is that right?
They do. There's a variety of scheduled events, John. The one that he's going to be addressing the largest audience is the Celebration of American Values. And then later that evening, the same day, he'll be at the NRA Foundation, or the fundraising dinner. And that's going to be a fundraising dinner that people can buy tickets for. There's a variety of items they have for auction. It's normally a high-end event. It's very well attended. And so a lot of good social and fraternal exchanges. I'll be there, and it'd be a good thing for anybody in the area to either look me up or buy a ticket to get there. It's all the money goes towards defending our freedom.
And just a reminder to everybody on ARFCOM, Joe's ARFCOM ID is Direct Action. So if you have any questions about any NRA events or any questions about the NRA at all, feel free to send him an IM. He'll answer all your questions for you. So this is a good chance, even if you're not going to buy anything at the auction, you could go rub elbows with some pretty high-end people and some celebrities and whatnot.
Well, most definitely. They're walking about. One good thing about anything involving the NRA, the people who come to speak are usually members of the NRA. They understand our people. I can tell you, John, I've been going to the annual meeting for quite a number of years now. I've never had a bad time. It's being around 60,000 of like-minded, like-thinking individuals, and you come across reinvigorated, re-energized, and ready to take on the world. A good bunch of people. It's a great social setting, and we got to get you down there next year.
Yeah, definitely next year. I'm making plans to go down there. While I'm there, I'm going to go visit the NRA Museum as well, and we're going to have Matt on later to talk about some of the stuff in there. I'm excited for that visit. Now, let's talk a little bit about what we have coming up here in 2 weeks, Joe. You've been working your butt off and helping us put together a really big show, and we kind of teased it a little bit last week, but why don't you let our listeners in on what we have planned here for the 26th?
Definitely, John, and it's been through a lot of your hard work and through the people that are associated with the show. If anybody sees me posting, they know I'm quite the advocate for all our military forces engaged in combat or those serving here domestically, as well as law enforcement and our fellow armed citizens. But on my avatar, if you will, my sig line is take action, support our SEALs. And there's a website you can go to, www.savetheseals.com, to basically explain what we're trying to do. On the 26th, we're dedicating the entire two-hour program to advocating the plight of the SEAL trio. These are the SEALs that, for whatever reason, the Pentagon felt deemed through their judge advocate general to lay charges against them. They are the SEALs that are arrested, quote-unquote, or detained. The person, the terrorist responsible for those killing those Blackwater contractors entering into Fallujah. They were the ones that were hung from the bridge entering into Fallujah. These SEALs are the wrongfully accused, in my opinion. We're going to dedicate the entire two-hour segment to educating our listening audience, hopefully driving them to three main websites that support their plight: SaveTheSeals.com, SaveOurSeals.com, and FreeTheSeals.com. You can go there now, take a look at the websites. We're going to have some great people on, some retired SEALs, some people that are going to, we have an attorney for one of the SEALs. We've got some other surprise guests, and we're going to ask ARFCOM to really come forward, sign the petitions. It's free. We have Scott Taylor coming on. Scott's running in the 2nd District of Virginia for Congress. Scott is a former Navy SEAL. He is an advocate for the SEAL trio. Great guy. We're going to ask you to support him in his attempts to become a congressman. There's a Warrior Defense Fund. We have Dave Bellavia on a couple weeks ago. Dave, a good friend for the Warrior Legacy Foundation. We stood up this defense fund for people to contribute. That money goes directly towards the defense of these three SEALs that are wrongly accused. So we've been working really hard to put together a great show. We hope that ARFCOM will come forward. They always do. They're very, very charitable, very benevolent, and it's going to be a show not to miss.
Yeah, I'm really excited for it. We're going to have some really cool guests on. We're actually going to have one of the attorneys for one of the SEALs to come on and give us as much of an overview as he can give us without jeopardizing the case at all, to really give us an insider's look. You won't get a better look at the situation that's going on with these SEALs than you will on this show coming up in 2 weeks. And we're really looking forward for ARFCOM to step up and help these guys out. I'm really excited for it. It should be a really interesting show and a lot of fun.
It's going to be a great one, John. It really is. This is, you know, you mentioned and we joked around a little bit, we're 12 weeks into it. And if you really look at the guests and the quality of guests we have brought forward and the steps we're taking now to make the show even better, I think in a short period of time, we're getting there. And I want to thank you for all your hard work and efforts, and Seth, our producer. It's coming forward. But without the great people out there who subscribe to ARFCOM, who lurk on ARFCOM, who help us out, we wouldn't be anywhere. So we really think we're taking the next step. We're going to the next level. And there's not a person out there who subscribes, lurks, or otherwise reviews ARFCOM that does not want to get involved in this. So it's think about yourself, my friend, because this is a good thing.
I appreciate the thanks. And like you said, it's all about the visitors, the members, the people that go to ARFCOM, the ARFCOMers of the world. This is all about you guys, and if it wasn't for you guys, we wouldn't be able to do some of the things we do. And I really like it when we get to pull off things like we're going to do for these SEALs, and we can help out people that go out, put their lives on the line for us in combat. I mean, these guys do the most dangerous missions that are out there, you know, and then they get railroaded like this on some bureaucratic horse crap. It's nice to know the ARFCOMers are going to step up, and we'll be able to make some kind of difference, hopefully help these guys out with their legal defense fund. It should be good to go. Anyway, Joe, I want to thank you for being on today. It's always good as usual to have you on. We'll have you on again next week. We'll talk a little bit more about the upcoming show, and we'll definitely talk about some more gun rights issues.
Fantastic, John. Look forward to it. Have a great show.
Thanks, my man. You have a great evening. That's Joe DeBurgolis, our resident NRA board member, the first ARFCOM-endorsed NRA board member, and we've got more board members, hopefully the NRA-endorsed members that will have been elected with the NRA election that just happened last month if you were a voting member of the NRA. I hope that you got a chance to vote in that election. It makes a difference, the people that we have on the NRA board, especially when it comes to the Black Rifle, the AR-15, and rifles like that, that we have guys that are sympathetic to our cause. We're not just regular gun owners. We're not the quote-unquote FUD gun owners. ARF Commerce, you know, we're a little bit different breed, and we promote a little bit different type of gun ownership. We're all in favor of the AR-15, and we need to make sure that we support not only political candidates, but NRA candidates as well that share those same views with us. Our next guest works for the NRA National Museum. His name is Matt Sharp. And, Matt, are you with us right now?
Yes, happy to be here. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for coming on. Phil Schreier is the one we usually have on. He's stuck in Oklahoma at the gun show out there. Is that right? He couldn't get a flight back?
Yeah, Phil, he's abroad right now, so he asked me to come and pitch hit for him. So I'm happy to be here, obviously, and I thank you for having us on.
It's great to have you on. I know you're his right-hand man, so I'm sure the quality won't diminish at all. You've got a couple of really cool weapons to talk about this week. I posted pictures of these weapons in the Radio Free ARFCOM discussion threads, in general discussion, and in the Radio Free ARFCOM forum for everybody listening if you want to see pictures of these. They're really cool. The first gun we have – well, you know what? Before we talk about the guns, let me ask a little bit about you. How did you get involved in the NRA Museum, and what exactly do you do there?
Well, in the summer of 2008, I interned with the National Rifle Association, working for their department called the National Firearms Museum. I got this job after senior curator Phil Schreier had read an article I had written on one of my favorite guns, the Model 1911. So I interned with the NRA for 3 months during that summer, and I went back to school at James Madison University, graduated, got my degree in history, and they signed me on at the NRA full-time in January of 2009. So my one-year anniversary with them was in January of this year, and I'm working there as an assistant curator. I work for Phil, who you had on the show about a month ago. He was talking about the Barrett 50 caliber from the Hurt Locker. And
right.
He and I, we travel around. We take traveling exhibits from our museum. We work in-house to set up new exhibits like the one I'm going to talk about tonight, and we do research, and we do a little bit of writing, and there's never a dull moment.
As a gun owner and a gun enthusiast, it seems like one of the best jobs in the world. I don't know how you can even get any work done there. If I was there, all I would do is spend all day walking around just drooling over all the guns and the exhibits you guys have there.
You know, like I said, there's never a dull moment. There's always, you know, I started working there, and the first thing I learned when I worked there is how much I don't know. So there is just, I'm always learning new things. I work among some of the best gun experts in the nation, and I learn something new every day. So it's really a great opportunity for me, a great experience, and I get my hands on some of the most rare and unique and valuable firearms that anyone has ever seen. So I'm grateful for what I do.
Yeah, that's just a really cool job and a cool story, actually. So you're a 1911 guy, huh?
Oh, yeah. Only the best handgun ever made.
We have a question that we ask our guests, and we banter about on AR15.com a lot, 9mm or 45 Glock or 1911. And I guess we know what camp that you fit in now. You're definitely the 45 1911, right?
You know, I'm kind of old school with this, and I'm going to say that the 45 is definitely my pick of the litter. You know, the 1911 is one of the best, you know, battle implements ever designed. It's field tested, it's been proven. The 45 ACP is one of the most widely used and popular rounds all over. So yeah, I'm going to have to go with the 45 on this one.
Okay, you're going to have a big following now on ARFCOM. You're going to have a whole lot of people that like this. So let's talk about some of these pieces that you're going to talk about tonight. We've got Mel Gibson's M16 from We Were Soldiers, and that's an awesome movie. It's on the ARFCOM approved list of movies that everyone should watch. Why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about this M16?
Okay, well, the picture I sent you is an actual picture of a rifle that's loaned to us from a guy named Mike Papik out of California. He runs a company called Cinema Weaponry, and what Mike does is he's a film armorer, and he basically works for major motion pictures. He's on set, and he's their gun guy. He's the guy that does all the engineering, the repairs. He's worked on major film productions. He was the armorer for Die Hard. He did We Were Soldiers, obviously. He did Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. So he was their gun guy. Now, Mike lent us this rifle. It's a fully automatic Colt M16 that has been adapted to fire blank ammunition. Like you said, it was used by Mel Gibson in his role as Colonel Hal Moore in the 2002 film We Were Soldiers. If you look at the picture, it's kind of done in the early setup of the M16. It's got the triangular fore end. It's got the open flash hider. You will notice a forward assist on there. Mike lent us this gun, and it was used by the star, Mel Gibson, and we're really happy to have it in our hands, and we've actually got it in the case that's on display today.
Okay, so it's got its own display there. And now, if I understand correctly, there's actually some other stuff that Mel Gibson wore. Some of the clothes and stuff he wore in his West Point ring that he wore in the movie are all there on display with it. Is that right?
Right. In his portrayal as Colonel Hal Moore, Mel Gibson had for his on-set costume, he was obviously in battle fatigues. We have on display next to the M16 rifle that he used in that film, props that he used on his costume. We've got two dog tags along with a St. Christopher medal. If you look at the dog tags, you'll notice that his character was Catholic. We've got a watch, Moore's West Point ring, and a medic alert bracelet worn by Gibson in the film.
Yeah, that's just cool. It's, some of the displays and the stuff you get is just amazing to me. It really is. Let's go ahead and talk about some of these other things we've got here. There's a shotgun up here, and let's talk about the shotgun first. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, we've got a shotgun that was used by the actor Ernest Borgnine in his role as Dutch Engstrom in Sam Peckinpah's 1969 classic The Wild Bunch. The gun itself is a Winchester Model 1897. It's a 12-gauge. It's a pump action. And that was one of the props that was used on that film.
Now, is this gun, in the picture you've given us, there's a knife there with it. Does the knife have anything to do with the movie? Is that just something that got put in the picture?
The knife, I think, is one of the implements of our photography crew. I think they didn't crop that out. But the gun was in the movie,
like a period piece.
And that is the prop.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I said the knife doesn't look like a period piece to me.
Oh, no, that's that was leftovers from our photography company. But they do good for work for us.
And if you haven't seen The Wild Bunch, everybody, you're an ARFCOMer. It's another one of those movies you have to go see. It's about an outlaw gang on the Texas-Mexico border, and they're getting a little bit older and kind of about the stuff they go through. It's a fun show. It really is a fun show. And you've actually got another really cool gun from that movie. The water-cooled Brown.
Yes, that's right. From that same film, we have a tripod-mounted Browning 1917. And what that is, you can see in the picture there, it's a water-cooled, belt-fed machine gun, chambered in .30-06. This one is adapted for blanks. It gained considerable screen time in the final shootout. The gun was used by several members of the cast. And one interesting thing about this gun, you can't see from the picture, but if you come to the display, you can see it up close. You could actually still see fake blood that's on the ammo box. It's red paint that still faintly shows up on the ammo box from that scene.
Oh wow, that's really cool, actually. So if we had a picture of the reverse side of this gun, then we'd be able to see it, right?
Oh yeah, and like I said, if you the picture I sent you has the ammo box kind of on the other side. If you turn it around, and we'll have this on full display at the National Firearms Museum, turn it around, you could actually see some of that prop fake blood that's still on the ammo box.
That's just cool. That's just a cool little bit to add to even a cool piece right there. So this is on display now, or it's going to be on display?
If you were to come to our museum tomorrow, you could see everything I'm talking about tonight. It's in our gallery. We have under construction for the actual display, but we kind of wanted to give a sneak peek to our visitors. So if you come to the National Firearms Museum, you could see all these guns open to the public, it's a work in progress, but we hope to have the final thing open within the next 2 to 3 weeks, and we're going to have it's going to be really something special. We're going to have all the signage up, and it's really going to be cool.
Awesome. So let me ask you a little bit more about your job as an assistant curator. Do you guys get people that call up and say, "Hey, I've got this old gun and I don't know what it is. Can you help me out?" Or does stuff like that happen all the time?
We get calls like that every day. There's not a day that goes by that someone doesn't call and says, "Hey, you know, I was rooting around in my grandpa's attic and I found this old lever action Winchester. What can you tell me about it?" And in fact, they preface their requests so often with, "I have this old gun," that senior curator Phil Schreier and American Rifleman editor Mark Keefe decided to title one of their inquiry articles, "I Have This Old Gun." So it's a question that's asked time and time again. We do tons of research for NRA members who have questions about firearms that want a little bit of the historical background on them, you know, that we get questions about serial numbers, manufacturing dates, all kinds of stuff. And I get stumped almost every day, so it's, like I said, I'm always learning something new. And we do actually have a fairly good firearms research service right there at NRA headquarters.
That's cool. I just can imagine people, you know, somebody dies in their family and they're going through their old stuff and it's like, "Holy cow, we didn't know Grandpa had this." How many people call up to say, "Hey, I've got this old gun. Do you guys want to display it?" And of those, how many do you guys actually take and put in the museum?
The policy in our museum is we put the best stuff in cases. The best examples of firearms are what get cased. And when you go through our museum, you'll see about 2,000 firearms on display, and that's the cream of the crop. It's the best of what we've got. In our building, two floors below is our vault, and we've got another 3,000 in our vault. Now, if it were up to me, I would have all guns on display all the time. Problem is, we just don't have the space to do that. We've gotten some very stellar, very exceptional donations in the past that have gone right into cases, it's just a policy about what they've got, but obviously we are willing to accept any generous donation, and we are very grateful for our donors for doing so.
Another question about the museum. I know you guys, you're open every day, is that right?
Right. We're open 7 days a week from 9:30 a.m. to 5 p.m.
And it's free for anybody. All you have to do is show up, and you get to see all these cool guns for absolutely nothing, right?
That's right. Admission is absolutely free. If you're an NRA member or not, it's free. It's appropriate for all ages. We are closed on major holidays, but like you said, we're open 7 days a week, 9:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. We're located right off of exit 57A. On Route 66, and that's in Fairfax, Virginia.
And what if you had to pick, you know, two or three pieces that are your favorite pieces in the museum? What would they be?
Well, probably
you have one that you have to go look at every single day. If you don't have a good day, if you don't go check it out.
Well, that would be every gun in the museum, I believe. But what I always like to point out, my favorites are, we've got all three Parker Invincibles. Now, what that is Parker is an American shotgun. They're American gun company, and they made their best three. The highest grade of a Parker shotgun is the Invincible grade, and there were only three of them ever made, and we've got all three in one of our cases. So that's one of my favorites. Probably one of the Mona Lisas of our galleries is we have a 17th century Italian wheel lock that was carried over on the Mayflower in 1620. So we refer to that as our Mayflower gun. Something else that's cool is we've got a Colt single action army revolver that was carried by one of Theodore Roosevelt's Rough Riders up San Juan Hill. We've got Dirty Harry's 44 Magnum, 44 Smith & Wesson Model 29 from the movie Dirty Harry and Magnum Force. So that's just a few of the treasures that we've got, and, you know, the list goes on and on.
That is just awesome. One last question. I got a couple questions, actually, before I let you go. One is, if you have kids and you want to bring your family there, is there stuff for the kids to look at, too, or are they just going to be bored walking around with dad all day looking at guns?
Well, if they're like me, you know, I could have been 5 or 6 years old, and I loved guns. You know, I grew up watching all, you know, all the Westerns with my dad, and, you know, I grew up watching, you know, Die Hard and Terminator and things like that. So there's never a dull moment. Whether you're new to firearms or whether you're one of the seasoned experts, you can find something for everybody in these cases. One of the real crowd pleasers with our younger generation is we actually feature two lightsabers that were used in the 1977 film Star Wars. One was used by Mark Hamill as Luke Skywalker. The other one was used by Alec Guinness as Obi-Wan Kenobi. So, like I said, there's something there for everybody.
Yeah, that's just cool. I have to admit, that's just cool. So you heard it, Arf Converse. It's just an awesome museum. His name is Matt Sharp, and he's assistant curator for the NRA National Firearms Museum. I want to thank you for being on. If we can't get Phil on next time, you'll be happy to fill in for him, right?
Oh, absolutely. I appreciate you having us on.
Oh, you're a great guest. You're just we didn't lose anything by having you on instead of Phil. Don't tell him I said that, though. All right, Matt, thanks for being on, and we'll look forward to hearing from you again.
All right, thank you for having fun. Have a good night.
All right. That was Matt Sharp, the assistant curator at the National Firearms Museum in Virginia for the NRA, and it's just a cool museum. I can't wait to go check it out. Just some of the stuff they got. I didn't know they had lightsabers in there. I mean, who thought they would have had two original lightsabers from the Star Wars movies? That's just awesome. So check it out, everyone. If you got a family, you can take your kids. It's free for everybody. You don't have to pay extra to get anyone else in. Just everybody walks in for free and check out all the cool guns. If you're an ARFCOMer, I know you're going to love it. That's for dang sure. So our next guest is a pre-recorded segment we have with Jarhead22. He's been a member on the site for a long time, and this is an extended get-to-know a little bit because he has a really interesting line of work, and so I had to really kind of get a little bit in-depth on it and let him tell us a couple of stories on it. I think you're going to be really intrigued with what you hear on this week's Get to Know. And this week on Get to Know, we have another great ARFCOMer, a longtime member here. I believe he's been a member before the board change. His name is Jarhead22. I'm sure everybody knows who he is. I certainly do. How are you today, Jarhead?
Very well, thanks. And you?
Doing well, doing well. Thanks for taking some time out to be on the show with us.
It's my pleasure.
And let's dive right in. You know, we always start off with the most important things here on Get to Know, the most life, earth-shattering, life-changing questions start right at the top, okay?
All right.
And you know what those are. The first one, the ubiquitous 9mm versus 45. What do you go with?
I'm a 45 man. You know, the old saying is, you know, a 45 might, a 9mm might expand, but a 45 will never shrink.
I love that answer. I really do. Beans or no beans?
Well, considering as how I live in Texas, the way I see it, beans are a side dish. You know, if you like beans, terrific. Have some beans with your chili.
You're in Texas. If you'd answered any other way, they would kick you out, right?
I'm telling you, they would have deported me. I'd end up in New Jersey or something.
Okay, next question is Glock 1911 or something else?
I'm a 1911 man from way back. I've got a Timber. I've got probably 22,000 rounds through. I've just got a lot of, I don't want to say, you know, muscle memory is typically the way people say it, but I've just got a lot of repetitions of the 1911. I liked the trigger. It points naturally for me. You know, it's reliable. It worked for Chesty Puller. It's good enough for me.
Yeah, if it works for Chesty, it's good enough for everybody, I think.
There you go.
So what do you do now for a living?
Well, I work in security. Right now, mostly stateside, although I'm kind of a utility outfielder, and when something odd comes up, I end up on a plane and go into interesting places. But different aspects, you know, instruction, project management, and like I said, just basic utility outfielder. Hey, you know, this guy is going on vacation. We need somebody to fill his seat for a month. Yeah, you know, send me over there.
Oh, wow. That sounds like a very, very interesting high-speed type career. How long have you been doing that?
Since about 2001.
Oh, so for quite a while now then.
Yeah, but, you know, coming up on 10 years, I guess.
Yeah, that's quite a long time. So where are some of the places you've been?
Well, let's see. You know, Iraq several times, Afghanistan once. I just spent, right after the earthquake, I spent a couple weeks in Haiti. And then on a job I worked for a couple of years on a full-time executive protection detail, I got to, I think, 31 or 32 countries in the course of 2 years. And
holy
that's
smokes.
Europe, Asia, you know, Central America, South America, you know, Russia, China, Brazil, Guatemala, Switzerland, France. You know, I've been did quite a bit of traveling on that job.
Wow, that sounds really, really cool, actually. So let me ask a couple questions about some of the places you've been then. Were you in Iraq during some of the, when the war was going on?
No, actually, I got there in 2004. Well, I mean, the war, yeah. I mean, the initial invasion, no.
Yeah.
But, you know, the
when the hostilities
effect,
were still
yeah.
in full swing.
Sure.
Right. So were there any places you've been to? I mean, okay, obviously Iraq and Afghanistan are dangerous. Like, we all know that. Are there any places you've been to that you thought maybe weren't going to be dangerous, and then when you got there, you were like, oh, wow, this is a lot different than I thought it would be?
I'll tell you, the China was interesting. I mean, the people were very nice, but we had sort of, you know, we had minders, I would say, you know, government security guys who were there for our protection, ostensibly. But, wow, I mean, it almost a PR nightmare. You know, they're pushing old ladies down in front of international news cameras. I didn't expect
oh, wow.
that. They're very heavy-handed. You know, I found Indonesia. I spent about a week and a half in Jakarta, Indonesia, and there are probably 20 or 30 motorbikes of one kind or another, little motorcycles or mopeds to every car there, and they have, I don't know, if they just don't understand the concept of physics, like momentum and things like that, or they just don't care because they swerve in front of cars with inches to spare, and you're expected, if you're in a car, just to stop for them. I found the same thing to be true in Haiti. So it's not so much dangerous out where I would be killed, but, you know, let's say the, you know, life isn't valued quite as highly or maybe just
right.
in the same way as what I'm used to.
Right. I totally understand that. I've been to a couple places that, yeah, that people are crazy sometimes. You get some of these other countries where, like when you talked about the motorcycles, I was in Africa, and, oh, man, some of the driving that goes on over there is just ridiculous.
Sure.
So let's talk a little bit about Haiti. You were there after the earthquake, correct?
Right.
I saw some of your pictures in that. What's your overall take on the situation over there? Is this something they're going to be able to rebuild from and make that a better place, or do you think they're just, you know, just the way they are and the way their society is, that it's just always going to be bad over there?
Well, they've got a bad record of, you know, even though the regime may change, the corruption stays the same. And a lot of the figures, a lot of the political figures and the people in charge stay the same. You know, when Aristide left, his prime minister was the guy who is now the president, not Prejean, what is his name? I don't remember the president's name now, I'm kind of embarrassed. But at any rate, the guy who was Aristide's prime minister became the president. The guy who is, you know, and now there's a new prime minister, well, that prime minister is sort of waiting in the wings. You know, he's the president's man. He will never betray the president. But as soon as the president makes a wrong step or steps aside, he's expecting to become president one day. And, you know, there's all kinds of NGOs, you know, Doctors Without Borders, and the UN is there, and, you know, all these different organizations, the U.S., of course, the European Union, and then independent, you know, France and Britain are there. Well, the government of Haiti demands that all relief efforts are coordinated and run through the government. And I don't know, am I cynical in saying that probably just so they can rake off a percentage? I don't know. Is that cynicism when it's happened 100% of every other time? The government aside, a lot of the international community is stepping up with money, and they have to because there's no homeowner's insurance in Haiti. If your house is wrecked, you know, start building a new one or you're just homeless. I mean, there's a million displaced people in Haiti right now living in these little tent camps that are made from essentially, the lucky ones have a tarp. It's mostly bed sheets and sticks and twine. So it provides a little bit of privacy, a little bit of shade, but we're getting into the rainy season now. The storms are going to start hitting, and all that's going to wash away.
I
believe the only solution in Haiti is going to be a military one. They're going to have to build almost like little military bases, FOBs like we have in Iraq. Put up a fence, put up tents. Okay, you, family of four, step forward. Here's your ID cards. These give you access to the tent or to the camp, and here's your tent. Here are your four cots. This is a chow hall where you can eat three meals a day. Kids, here's your shots. You know, here's the school you're going to go to every day. You know, here's your laundry point. Here's your shower and toilet point. You know, it's got to be organized, and I believe the Haitians would go for that. I don't know that the Haitian government would, but I believe the Haitian people would.
Yeah, I'm sure the people over there are just are dying for some type of organization. I mean, I can just imagine just from some of the images I've had. And I've been kind of wondering myself, what happens, you know, we've got hurricane season coming up. What happens if a hurricane hits over there now? I mean, that's just a recipe for total disaster, isn't it?
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, think about this. There's almost no sanitary, you know, toilets and showers set up at these tent camps because they're literally in the middle of any flat, open ground. Google Earth has updated their imagery since the earthquake. So you can go onto Google Earth and see what things look like right now on the ground or, you know, maybe a week or two ago or a month ago in Haiti. And look for the bright blue patches as you scroll down on Google Earth in Haiti. Those are tarps. And a couple of those together means you found a tent camp. Just next to the National Palace, there's a parking lot, and it's become a tent camp.
Oh, wow.
Now, there's no toilets there. There's no place to shower. People set up a little, you know, they make a booth out of a tarp, and they take, you know, bucket showers. Well,
yeah.
What happens when a storm hits and washes away or washes into what these people have been using as a toilet and washes it through their tent? That's the recipe for cholera right there.
Yeah, disease and just... it's just sad to see what's happened over there. It really is. I mean, yeah, a lot of it can be, you know, you contribute a lot of it to the people of the country, I guess, and the way they've allowed their government to run things, but it's still a sad situation.
Absolutely, man. I'll tell you. I mean, and I think we're not going to really see violence until we see people dying of disease and, you know, neglect. Now, there is some food aid getting out there. But, you know, and things may have become much more organized since I left. I don't know. I left in the middle of February, but I don't know. I'll believe it when I see it. I'll, you know, when I see on the news how, you know, there's, you know, houses or camps, you know, organized camps being built and people are being put to work, you know, because there's a lot of people out of work because people's offices and stores and things have collapsed. So
right. Get
those people. Haiti needs to be rebuilt. So someone start teaching these people how to lay brick. You know, how to run electrical wire, how to lay pipe, things like that, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens the next few years over there, if they can actually, you know, dig themselves out of this hole. But I don't know. I'm not optimistic about how it's going to end up over there. I'm just really
well,
not.
Well, they don't have a good history, but, you know, there's going to be a lot of money being poured in. They were asking for, I think, $4-point-something billion, and they just had a donors conference last week where the international community has promised $10 billion. We'll see how much of that actually happens, but if they've doubled the request, even if they only come through with half, they've still met all of Haiti's requests. So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see what happens over there. We will. Just a little more questions about your work. When you started doing your security work, how did you get into that? Now, I'm sure your name is Jarhead, so I'm sure you're an ex-Marine, right?
Right.
So
well,
you went straight. Did you go straight out of the Marines into that, or did you have to? Going to some other training?
No, I did some other stuff first. You know, basically, I went to the Marines. When I got out of the Marines, the telecom bubble was just kind of getting some legs under it, and I got work in telecom. We did that for a couple of years, and then around 2001, that's when the bubble burst. That's when, you know, companies, everything was unregulated, so now long distance can sell local and internet and, you know, cable TV can sell phone service and everything else. Well, all those different companies had bought equipment and were selling it, and they just totally maxed the market out. And after a while, nobody was buying new gear, and the bubble burst. And the company I worked for, which was a major player in telecom, went from 95,000 employees down to about 25, and I got laid off. I got stock options my last year there, and the strike price was $141 a share, and they're now a penny stock.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And all the customers who had offered me jobs when I was in there, in their facilities doing work, I'm calling them back trying to get a job. You know, I got a couple months severance when I left, but I'm calling trying to get a new job, and everybody's telling me, oh, we just laid off 2,500 people, or, oh, I just got laid off, or, no, there's no way, we got nothing. So after a couple months of that, I took some of my severance, and I had talked to some other people that were in the security business about, you know, what it took, what, you know, could I be, was I viable? And I went and got some training and some licensing, and happened to get a hookup. It's one of those things, man. Every place you go, every training opportunity and everything else, treat it like a job interview, because many of them end up being just that. And that's some advice, you know, people have asked me, oh, how do you get into that business that you're in? And that's what I tell them. Get some specific training and treat every training opportunity as a job interview. And it was a guy who I did some training with at a school who, you know, got a call saying, hey, we're looking for a guy. And he said, well, I might know a guy. He called me up and said that there might be something going on. And then he called another guy whose training class I went to after his and said, what do you know about this guy? How did he do? And apparently I got a good report card. And he said, okay, when you get back to town, call this guy. He's looking for somebody. And, you know, that got me my first foot in the door, my first job in a full-time detail.
Oh, okay, cool. That's a cool little story right there. You know, people, I've always wondered myself anyway, that, you know, how do people get into that? Like, you have to be a special forces operator to get into that, or is that some, but I guess if you just, it's probably a small, close-knit community even amongst the different companies, isn't it?
It is a small community, and it's one of those things where you have to get yourself a reputation for being the guy who does the right thing when no one's looking, but somebody's always looking.
Right.
You know, you can never just assume, oh, I'm standing out here in this alley for 8 hours on night shift, you know, basically, you know, watching this at the back door, so nobody comes in the back door, standing here next to a dumpster, nobody's going to see if I, you know, if I sit down or if I read a book or whatever. Yeah, somebody's going to see. So you have to be that guy that people can count on. And when you get yourself a reputation for something like that, the phone calls come, you know.
Oh, okay.
It's just worked out well. I was never any kind of special forces guy. I was just another Marine with no kind of, you know, special anything on my DD-214, my military record. But, you know, I got some advice. Hey, get some specific training. You want to work in executive protection? Get some specific executive protection training. Go to a driving course. Go to this driving course because this is the one that everybody knows. So it just kind of worked out well. And then the advice I got, the people who gave me the advice, hey, you're doing well. You know, I got the recommendation. Once I got that first full-time job, I got some calls. And on my weekends off and stuff, I did some small-time kind of like celebrity and corporate gigs, which is, you know, temporary jobs, but that puts you in touch with more people, and you build that network, hand out business cards, exchange email addresses.
Right. That's interesting. That's just really cool. It's one of those careers that's just, there's a lot of intrigue and mystery to it, and I'm glad you could crack the ice on some of that for us.
Sure, sure. And, you know, I've never once carried Whitney Houston across the stage. you know, it's just not as sexy as it looks. But it's pretty interesting, and I've got to go a lot of cool, you know, I've flown on presidential helicopters, I've, you know, rubbed elbows with Secret Service guys, with presidential details from countries all over the world, you know. So it's I've got to do some interesting, fun stuff and see some cool stuff.
That sounds cool. That begs another question. When you're working with someone who's high profile, and maybe you get in a situation where you're there with working for someone, and then there's someone there from the government who's got government people working for them, how do you guys get along with the government people? Are they cool with you? The private sector guys, do they look down on you, thinking they're a little better? Is there a rivalry there, or is it pretty professional?
Well, you know, I've dealt with Secret Service, you know, presidential detail, vice presidential detail, and then Secret Service protection guys for when foreign heads of state come to America, they get Secret Service protection. And never did I get any kind of, you know, you're just, you know, whatever, Joe Private guy. It's how you approach it. You know, the Secret Service is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. If they're there, they're running the show.
Right.
You know, I was at an overseas venue where the U.S. Secretary of Treasury was there, and he had his Secret Service detail, and our guy was there, and there was kind of a little international incident brewing where the host country was, you know, we all had these all-access passes to go with our principal into the event. Well, all of a sudden, the host country said, nope, you got to stop here at the barricade, and only the principals can go. Well, that's not how we do things. So what we did was we basically had a huddle. All the details got together, and because these host country guys were like, we're grabbing guys, and you don't grab the, you know, head of the Secret Service detail for the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. You just don't lay hands on the guy.
Right.
So we all kind of huddled up and said, okay, how can we do this? How can we make, you know, do what we know we have to do, how we accomplish our mission. And we just kind of came up with a plan, sort of formed a big scrum. You know, we had Secret Service guys, we had European detail guys, probably 20 of us all just put all of our principles in the middle, made a big scrum, like a wedge, and pulled through. And as each of the host country national security guys grabbed one of us, that guy just kind of peeled off and pushed, I don't be too specific, the host country security guy kind of back away from the principals. And then the principals and the PSO, hands-on, arms-length guy, all got through. So, you work together when you have to, and, you know, you basically prove yourself either as a professional or a doofus, and the doofuses kind of get, you know, shunted to the side.
Wow, this just sounds so cool, man. It just sounds like just an interesting, interesting line of work. All right, let's move on to something a little bit more light, lighthearted. When you're settling in on a Friday evening and you're going to sit down for a few hours on ARFCOM, what's your go-to drink? What's your drink of choice?
Well, I'd say it's kind of seasonal. I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of Yingling Lager. So I've always got a few of those in the fridge. Also,
I've never had that. It gets talked about a lot on ARFCOM. I'm going to have to find a way to get some of those. I've never had that.
Yingling, it's the longest continually operating brewery in America.
Oh, wow.
They're in Pennsylvania. And for a long time, you couldn't get it outside of, you know, 6 or 8 counties in Pennsylvania. Now it's all up and down the East Coast. And they have it in Texas as well. I'd say for hard liquor, I think it's seasonal. I like in the summertime, I like a gin and tonic with lime. In the colder times, I like a little Irish whiskey.
Oh, okay. I like that answer. So you have several drinks that you can go to. I like that.
I'm adaptable, you know.
Yeah, you have to be, right, in your line of work.
That's it.
Who is your favorite musical artist or group? This is a new question. You're the first one that we've asked this question to. I figured I could get rid of a couple of the other questions and put in a couple new ones, and this is one of the new ones I put in. When you're kicking back, you want to relax, or when you just want to hear some good music, who do you go to?
I'm a longtime fan of Social Distortion.
Oh, Social D, okay.
Yeah. And, you know, Mike Ness also has a couple of solo albums out, and I actually saw him in concert on the Cheating at Solitaire tour. Great show. And, he actually did a couple of acoustic Social D songs on that tour as well. You know, so that's what I like. I like Social D. There's a lot of different stuff going on there from their early days as a straight-out punk band. They got some rockabilly influences. I like
right.
Social D.
So I am very familiar with them. That's a good choice, very good choice. Let's see here. Let's go back to some ARFCOM questions. Who do you like on ARFCOM? Who's your favorite poster? Do you have a favorite poster or a favorite type of poster? Someone that maybe you look forward to hearing what they're going to say and chime in on a subject?
You know, there's a bunch of other security guys on ARFCOM, and, you know, it's always good to get another perspective. Somebody like Rusted Ace, you know, he's done a lot of work in Afghanistan, where I've only been to Afghanistan. I think I spent a total of a month and a half there. He's been there for years, and, you know, it's good to get his perspective on things. But, you know, honestly, I think I would have to say there's a couple different people. Number one, you know, going back to from the early days, Eric the Hun was kind of the eminence grise of ARFCOM. And, you know, even before I ended up meeting him and becoming very good friends with him, you know, you could disagree with him vehemently and still, you know, come to some kind of, pleasant end to the conversation. Even if you didn't change your mind, he didn't change his mind. You know, he was always a gentleman, and that was in person as well.
We've got a couple of votes for Eric the Hun. I wish I'd have been around on ARFCOM back then when he was around. He just sounds like such a great guy, kind of like the spirit of ARFCOM, what ARFCOM really is all about. It just seems like he's that guy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and there were many DFW crew get-togethers where the only real instruction, like usually for a gun show, and the only real instruction was, okay, you know, and we'll meet up at Brother Nick's table at noon, and we'll go get some lunch, and we'd go to Uncle Julio's or something like that, and it was always a good time.
Let's talk about mods, moderator, site staff. Who's your favorite?
You know, I would say probably DK Prof. You know, I've met him a couple times, and, you know, gone out to dinner and lunch with him, and, you know, met his lovely wife. And just a real kind of easygoing, laid-back guy. He's been to a lot of different places. He's done a lot of different things. You know, he used to have a hell of a mustache. so, you know, just, you know, and his style is very sort of laid-back on the board. You know, even when he has to say, you know, easy guys, you know, you're no posting this or no personal attack that, you know, he has a light touch, but he gets the job done. I like his style.
Yeah, I like that guy, too. I've been trying to get him on a Get to Know. He won't come on. I don't know why he won't come on. But, so if you talk to him, you tell him, hey, man, you got to get on there. We need to hear. Hey, ARFCOM needs to know you.
Maybe he's wanted in 15 countries. Who knows?
Probably is for the goose thing anyway. Let's see. If you live in Texas. Your profile says you live in Tennessee.
Yeah. Well, the company that I went to Iraq with in 2008, when my contract there ended, they offered me a full-time corporate office job. Well, the corporate office is in Tennessee, so I'm basically squatting in a little apartment out here, and I get home, you know, from time to time. Sometimes I get to work remotely, you know, from the home office, and I get to spend some time at home, but not often enough. And, boy, you know, if I couldn't live where I'm living now, where I'd like to live is actually in my house. That's my answer.
You knew that was the next question coming up. Where would you live if you could live anywhere? You'd live in your house instead of having to always be on the road, huh?
Exactly. You know, and it's a cool kind of job. Cool, you know, you get to go do interesting things and go to interesting places. But after a while, you know, I just want to lay down in my big California king bed and watch my widescreen TV and, you know, just enjoy kind of, you know, the fruits of my labor sometimes.
Yeah, you will. You will one of these days. You'll be able to kick back, and then you'll be wishing you were still back in the high-speed business. what is your favorite firearm that you currently own?
I've got a Springfield Armory MC Operator, which was the 1911. It's a railed 1911 that they tried to sell to the Marine Corps as the off-the-shelf replacement for the Musak pistol. And I think the Kimber Desert Warrior ended up being the one they picked. But I got one. Really liked it, but it needed a few things to make me happy. And two different guys have done some work on it, and now I think I've actually posted a couple pictures of it. But you know, I had a magwell put on it. I had that kind of goofy looking green and black color scheme is gone. I got it Cerakoted, which I'm digging the Cerakote finish.
Oh, okay.
So
yeah,
that's the one. That's my kind of go-to. You know, when it comes to a handgun.
That's a cool little piece right there. Actually, interesting little.
Yeah,
piece.
I dig it.
If you could have any one firearm that's legal for you to own that you do not currently own, what would that be?
Okay, I have to answer that question with a question.
Okay.
Are there any pre-1986 registered M249 saws?
Oh, wow. See, I...
Yeah, see if there... You know,
I don't know. That's your dream gun, though, a saw, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I carried one for about 6 months in Iraq and sort of had a little kind of close relationship going. You know, I named it.
Oh,
so,
oh yeah. What did you name it?
Well, it was her. I named her. She was the bitch hog. And,
the bitch hog.
You know, caress the bitch hog, you know, on sweaty days and cold nights, and had kind of a relationship going there. And, you know, still every once in a while I just think, wow, wouldn't it be great? Yeah.
But I wonder, that's a good question. I wonder if there are any. When did it come into service? It came into service... I don't know. That's a really good question. I'm going to have to do a little research on it. I guarantee somebody listening
knows. It was the late 80s or early 90s, and that's when the Marine Corps got it anyway, was the late 80s. And I don't know if there are any. There's very few on the books, I'm sure, and no doubt they're, you know, upwards of 25 grand.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they're way out of my price league.
Yeah.
So you've already answered this question, but I'll ask it to you. Have you ever met an ARFCOMer in real life, and what was your first or your general overall impression of ARFCOMers?
Well, you know, I'll tell you what, the DFW crew is very active. They get together, you know, regularly for shoots and gun shows and just dinners every month and stuff like that. You know, great guys. I mean, you know, my wife, you know, likes a bunch of the guys, and, you know, hey, yeah, terrific, you know, yeah, invite them over, you know, and stuff like that. When, you know, if I'm hoping we're having a barbecue or something, you know, good guys, you know, generally, you know, gentlemen and fun to be around and not kind of, you know, one-track mind. All we can talk about is guns. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, it's good to have broad interests. And, you know, I haven't had any problem. It's like anything else. You know, there's always one, you know, you don't want to be that guy. And once in a while you run into that guy. But in general, shooting people are the nicest people I've met.
Right. Yeah, me too. Gun owners are just a great category of people in America. You just,
exactly.
You get that common thread, and there's a lot more that comes with being a gun owner that keeps us all in common and on the same page. That's what I love about it. Like one of our other, I can't remember who it was, a couple weeks ago on a Get to Know, he said, you know, sometimes there's, like you said, that guy, but it seems like he'll only show up maybe one time and then he realizes he's that guy and doesn't come back. So I guess there's
a little peer pressure, you know?
Yeah. A little ARFCOM peer pressure keeps the flies away, I guess you could say. Let's see what the next question is here. Okay. What is your favorite non-GD section of the forums?
I would say the survival forums. You know, the survival gear, you know, the kind of like the food and garden, the survival, you know, general survival. You get all kinds of people in there, all kinds of opinions. And, you know, I wouldn't say I'm, you know, a hardcore, you know, I'm putting solar panels on the roof or anything like that, but it's something I've considered, you know. And, you know, I like to think that I'm better prepared than the average bear, but, you know, there's still more stuff I have to do. And you get some folks in there who've just done some ingenious things. You know, there was a guy, I can't remember, a poster, I can't remember his screen name now, who his company had, they were either preparing for storms or they had had storms before and their power grid was a little shaky, and they had him put together some kind of, he had to come up with a solution where people could temporarily power their computers, you know, with a rechargeable thing, and these UPSs apparently that, you know, are really only to give you enough power to shut your computer down without it crashing. So this guy came up with this deal, these batteries with inverters mounted on the box, just a really ingenious solution.
I have a feeling that I am looking at that thread as we speak, because it's one of the ones I have not finished reading all the way through. I know exactly. It's either the MOS 2111 thread, the attempt at home power, or there's another one where the guy is. I think it's the other one where the guy put together these power boxes and he actually put how long and how many watts he got out of it and how long he could run certain different things off of. Is that the same one?
That's the one. It's the second one. Yeah. Where you know. You know how many amps it could draw over how long, and
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
just brilliant. You know, I mean,
yeah,
he tested all this stuff out, and he comes and says, "Hey, this is successful. I've done it. It's out there working right now in the field. It might be an option for you." And then the other people chimed in with, "Hey, I found this cart," and it became sort of a collaborative there to about the second or third page with, "Hey, I found this cart that would work if you have to move it around," and on, really good stuff.
Yeah, the survival forum is outstanding on AR15.com. It's probably the best one on the internet. You can go to a myriad of sites and not get the kind of stuff you get on that one. It's just, oh, I love this. I do admit, I spend a lot of time there. I do spend a lot of time there.
It's not just, you know, a bunch of guys who are, you know, digging in and, you know, all that kind of stuff. You get, you know, network engineers. You get heavy equipment operators. So you get people with vast different backgrounds that they contribute. It's really a good resource.
Yeah, it's outstanding. It really is. Let's move on here. The next question I have for you is, have you ever gotten rid of a firearm and regretted it?
Man, I'll tell you what. I still have a hole in my heart. When I first got out, you know, when I was in the Marines, I married a California girl, got out of the Marines, got a job right there in Southern California, and I had a, you know, at the time this was a concern, I had a pre-ban national match Springfield Armory M1A.
Oh, wow.
And I know. I had gotten the Turner Sadlery sling for it, and I had, you know, 8 or 10 really nice mags for it. I had, you know, the Springfield Armory scope mount. I had the, you know, where it also has the little, you can reload it with stripper clips, that little attachment that goes on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I had the full kit, the GI cleaning kit. You know, it was just top-notch, you know. And problem was, you know, I was a civilian, so I didn't have access to the, you know, to the ranges like at Camp Pendleton, for instance. And the longest range I could find that I could shoot on was 100 yards. And I just thought, you know, it's a waste. I've got, you know, all this money tied up in a wonderful firearm that I don't really get to use. So I ended up selling it and buying something else. And honestly, maybe less than a year later, I got transferred to Texas, where there's, you know, I can drive out the TAC-PRO and shoot it 1,000 yards.
Oh, that's brutal. That is brutal,
oh, man.
Right there.
It's like I said, I still have that painful hole in my heart every time I think about it.
Oh, that's have you tried to replace it yet? Have you got another M1A to replace it?
No, but I have a couple. You know, I got a good deal on a good condition STG 58 kit for, you know, so I'm building myself an FAL.
Oh, okay.
Not quite the same thing, but it's a, you know, 308 battle rifle, so it's, you know.
That's a tough story right there, man. That is a tough one. Do you remember the first time you ever shot a firearm and what the story was behind that?
Yeah, just, you know, out with Dad, kind of, you know, introduction to firearms 101, you know, got the whole speech at home about the four rules and everything else, you know, and how, you know, it's a tool like anything else, and, you know, I wouldn't hand you a chainsaw and not tell you how to use it, so, hey, this is how we're going to use this tool, and, you know, you never vary from these rules. And then we went out and it was a little Marlin magazine, the tubular magazine pump action Marlin 22.
Oh yeah, the good old 22, man. It's a great gun to get started on.
I slayed many squirrels with that gun.
It's great when your dad or someone in your family teaches you. It's just, you get that generational thing, man, and that love is there forever. It just stays.
Exactly. It's a handoff, you know.
Yeah, it's great. I love it. And it's sad. It's a sad thing that in our country that handoff is starting to die. We need as gun owners to do as much as we can. That's why I love like the Take a Kid shooting programs and all that stuff. Just to kind of, if we don't get this next generation as responsible gun owners, man, it's gonna be bad news in the future for us, I think.
You're absolutely right. We've got to increase the ranks.
Okay, last question here. I like to ask this one at the very end, get people's response to it. If you were elected president, what would be the first thing you did in office?
I would triple the funding for the CIA's Special Activities Division.
Oh, okay. And just let them go do it, huh? Just let them get out there and get the job done, huh?
You know, they're some very effective guys. You know, that was like the Johnny Michael Spann and the other guy. Forget it, it was like Dave or something like that, who were there at Mazar-e Sharif. You know, there's all kinds of interesting stuff has happened with a little help from the SAD guys, you know. The SAD guys were some of the first ones into Afghanistan, along with a couple of Special Forces guys. And they managed to get stuff done and, you know, stuff that makes the papers, but their presence, you know, usually doesn't make the papers. But very effective cats.
That's a good answer, and yeah, I'll bet there's so much stuff that we just have no clue about. That just if we knew, we'd just be so thankful, and we would be like you, like let's triple it, let's quadruple what they get, man, because these guys get the job done. And
there
you gotta have guys like that. Rough men stand ready to do violence on our behalf, and that's the
exactly.
way it works, right?
Exactly. You know, I'm not. There's some like let's say you know gangbangers, you know. In America, you know, that's a problem crying out for a solution, but I'm not willing to give the government, you know, like the full star chamber, solve it any way you want to, go full, you know, take the El Salvador route on these guys or the Pinochet route on these guys. I'm not ready to give anybody that kind of unchecked power, but, you know, the SAD guys have a program there where they get their orders and, you know, select committee on intelligence, you know, gets the briefing whether Nancy Pelosi wants to admit it or not, and, you know, the job gets done.
Hey, I really appreciate you taking some time out to be on with us today, man. I really do. And thanks for shedding so much insight into the world of personal protection, because it's just, it's one of those things that you read about in books and you see on TV, but, you know, the reality is always different, and it's just awesome to get that perspective from someone who's in the trenches every day with it. It's just really cool.
Good deal, good deal. I'm glad I could help.
Hey, thanks a lot, man. And his name is Jarhead, 22.
One of the best
ARFCOMers we've got around. He's a really great guy, and we really appreciate him here on Get to Know. And we're back from Get to Know, live again on Radio Free ARFCOM. Hosted by AR15.com, the home of the Black Rifle. We've got a great guest coming up. Before we do, I want to talk a little bit about that last interview. He was talking about an M249 he'd like. I guess there are M249s out there that you can get. Are we back live, Seth? We're back live. Radio Free ARFCOM. I'm John Gold, your host. Really quick, before we move on to our next guest, I want to talk about the M249 that Jarhead 22 was just talking about. I guess there are some available. We had a caller call up during that segment. It was Blade PG from Connecticut. He called up. He said that we should go talk to Dan Shea with Long Mountain Outfitters. I went to their website. There are M249s out there. I have not found one to get a price on one, but he said they cost about as much as a house, and I can believe it. But, oh, man, talk about a fun gun to have. All right, let's go right into our next segment here. This is going to be a really interesting segment, and I've been waiting a while to do a show on this specific topic, and it seems like right now is as good a time as any. We've got Daniel Miller. He's the president of the Texas Nationalist Movement. They're the number one Texas secession movement that's around right now. Daniel, you're with us. Hello, Daniel. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. There we go. Outstanding. Hey, thanks for taking some time out and being on the show with us. Before we get started, I just want to let the listeners know if you've got any questions for Daniel, feel free to call up, and we'll get you live on the show with him. If you don't want to call, you can IM me on ar15.com. Just send me an instant message. Send me an email at radiofreearfcom@gmail.com. Or if you're a part of our Facebook group, Radio Free Arfcom Facebook group, go ahead and put a message up on the wall there, and I'll get to your question. If you're not a member of the Facebook group and you are on Facebook, please join the group, Radio Free Arfcom. Just do a search for it, and you'll get in. So, Daniel, let's talk a little bit about your background here first and how you got involved with the Texas Nationalist Movement, where you came from before that and whatnot.
Sure. It's always pretty interesting. It's often I have to do the personal exposition because, you know, there are people out there that don't necessarily understand how somebody gets to be a Texas secessionist, so to speak. And, you know, it's like I had to answer this question Saturday when we did the grand opening of our new office. My background is nothing particularly special. You know, I was raised by my grandparents. Daddy was born in 32. Mom was born in 28. You know, they had that Depression era mentality. And it was always, you know, pretty interesting growing up because they always held that out. But one thing that they always taught me was that it's not enough to just sit there and complain at the TV when you see things coming out of Washington, D.C. or even local government that you don't like. You have to get involved. Dad was an old school Yellow Dog Democrat. He was a union guy. He was an iron worker for 35 years, so straight up blue collar upbringing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as I got older and as he got older, I began to see things that just didn't make sense to me, you know, things that I was taught in the Constitution, things that I was taught about how this country should be. And so I began to get involved. From the time I jumped out of high school, I ran for mayor of my hometown when I was 18 years old. I jumped feet first in to try to have a voice and to try to have a say and figure out really what was going on. So as things progressed and I began to see this erosion of the Constitution and seeing these quote-unquote elected leaders just act with complete indifference to us, the people, I began to really get upset, really frustrated. And, you know, one of the things that you find here in Texas is one of the things that we are brought up is we're Texans. You know, there's a certain pride that goes along with it and a certain national sense that goes along with being a Texan. So along about 95, 96, we started hearing some rumblings about folks that wanted to be, you know, Texas wanting to be an independent nation. So my whole family went down and signed up. We joined the movement for Texas independence and have been involved ever since.
That's interesting. So it kind of comes from your family.
To a certain extent, you know, there's, you know, you know, the folks always taught me to think for myself, which, of course, jumped up to bottom on occasion. But, you know, when you've got a, you know, some old school thoughts versus some new school thoughts, but you know, it's one of those things. It was just a conclusion that we came to, you know, and we decided it as a family. You know, I was grown by the time that all took place, and you know, I was an adult. I had a family of my own, and you know, it was one of those situations where we kind of took the same path together. I always tell people, you don't wake up one day and say, look, I think we ought to be independent. You know, it's a journey that you have to go through. And of course, as a family, we ended up in that same spot in that journey at the same time. But, you know, I have absolutely no doubts that it was kind of a race between us to see which one of us was the most Texan at the time.
So how did you end up with being the president?
Well, just through a succession of different events, you know, when I got involved, I jumped in feet first and, you know, started working out on the local level, doing as much as I could. I volunteered for everything because there's a certain amount of enthusiasm and excitement that comes with it. And then just through, I guess, showing the membership that I was capable. They chose me, and I'm proud to have the position. I still think that I'm underqualified for it, but I work my tail off for those guys every single solitary day.
That's cool. Tell me about the Texas Nationalist move. What's the goal is for Texas to secede eventually, but tell me about the movement itself, the people involved, and the kind of the principles you guys stand behind.
Yeah, it's been kind of typical to be painted as a secession movement, but that really is the independence issue is the one that's in the forefront now. But we actually, if you look at our mission and our vision, we operate in three different areas where independence is concerned. Of course, political, which is the hot topic right now. But we also work in the areas of cultural, historical, and economic. So, we are kind of what I would consider a well-rounded organization in that regard. We're not just kind of a one-trick pony where the political side of this is concerned. But we are, we do a lot of things. Our demographic makeup is pretty diverse, which is, again, contrary to how the mainstream media loves to paint us as an angry white men's movement. We're a pretty even mix of men and women. We are very represented in all ethnic groups. I mean, we're as diverse as Texas is because, frankly, every one of us here, no matter the race, color, creed, male, female, doesn't matter. We're just sick of Texas sitting under the boot heel of Washington, D.C. and spending our way into an economic oblivion.
Yeah. People hear the word nationalist, and the first thing they think is some type of racist organization, or you think of the Nazis, the National Socialist Party. Did you guys have any fears about that when you went with the name the Texas Nationalist Movement?
No, what we did was, and where the name really derives from, is Mirabeau Lamar was the second president of the Republic of Texas back in the 1830s. And he is, he's been, of course, down here, they call him the father of Texas education because he was a big proponent of compulsory education and funding education. But the other thing that he's well known for is he's known as the father of Texas nationalism. He was the president in the old republic that best felt and advocated the most for Texas being a nation, and standing and doing all the things that nations do. So, one of the things that we decided to do was, just kind of abandon that thought that people say nationalist and, they're a bunch of skinheads or this, that, or the other. We'll let those guys answer for what they believe. But for us, we hold that quotation from Steinbeck where he says that Texas is a nation in every sense of the word. Or Sam Houston when he said that Texas will again lift its head and stand among the nations. We are really about exploring the national character of Texas and securing our sovereignty and independence along those lines.
So is there a legal procedure? You always hear about, Texas has it in their constitution that they can secede. They were once their own country and they have an agreement. What is the legal procedure, I guess, where Texas could secede from the Union?
Well, and it was kind of funny to actually even hear that from Governor Perry when he said that Texas, when we entered, had the right to leave at any time, and it was in the treaty. First off, there was actually no treaty of annexation that was ratified by the United States Senate, so that was false in and of itself. And there is no explicit clause in our Constitution or in our laws that say that Texas can secede. But what we explained to people is that there was absolutely no need at the time those documents were written because the right for a state to leave the Union pre-existed the Constitution. The right for a state to have self-determination pre-existed the foundation of the Constitution. Otherwise, you would be paying taxes to Mexico or to the Queen of England right now. Ultimately, secession is the first American right. The colonies seceded from Great Britain and took that character of independent sovereign states, and it says so in the Declaration of Independence. So, the principles of self-determination pre-exist the Constitution, regardless of any, legality or any kind of law that's been passed. There doesn't have to be a secession law for there to be secession. But what is interesting about this is that for Texas, we've always known this. This is something that we've been brought up with and we're taught. But it's also a very liberating thing for other states as well. The Union has been a great thing, that we can bind together. But there comes a time when there is you have a choice. Do you sit here and continue to argue and fight and have someone impose their will upon you, and then in turn you fight to try to impose your will upon them? Or do you just agree to disagree and to separate? And it's something that is very much akin to political divorce.
Okay, you mentioned Rick Perry a little while ago. Now, I know you, the Texas Nationalist, group that you're with, the Texas Nationalist Movement, you guys actually supported Deborah Medina, correct?
We did. Deborah Medina was the first statewide office candidate that we had ever endorsed as an organization.
And then Rick Perry got the nomination, if I'm not mistaken.
He did get the nomination.
So do you guys now put your support behind him?
Well, right now we're still holding out. One of the things, Rick Perry for us is kind of a double-edged sword, and it's one of the reasons that we endorsed Medina in the primaries. Rick Perry does, he's done some things that frankly are kind of make us bristle. You know, people that are proponents of individual freedoms and constitutional government, he's done some things that really make us bristle. But those are occasionally interrupted by some points of brilliance. You know, for example, his statements on secession and independence and sovereignty back last year. So, you know, where Rick Perry is concerned, it's kind of a mixed bag for us. We really, at this point, it doesn't matter to us who sits in the governor's mansion, because, frankly, we're intending to plow this through the legislature to get a referendum on independence. And there is a mechanism for us to actually get that referendum on the ballot via constitutional amendment where the governor is not even part of the equation. It would be helpful if he were on board, but it's not entirely necessary.
So the ultimate goal is for Texas to become an independent nation, and to do that you would have to pass legislation through your Texas House and the Texas Senate, right?
Right. And that's ultimately, we've got to get down to a referendum. That's the bottom line. Whatever mechanism we get to, or whatever mechanism gets us there, the ultimate goal for us is a referendum. Article 1, Section 2 of our Constitution says that all political powers inherent in the people, and they have at all times the inalienable right to reform, alter, or abolish their government as they deem expedient. So Article 1, Section 2 actually forms the cornerstone of our strategy for securing Texas independence. We have to get a referendum. We have to get the vote, and we have to win the vote. It doesn't matter what the legislature or governor decide. Ultimately, it comes to a vote of the people, and the people of Texas will decide.
Okay. Have you got anybody in the legislature to propose anything like that?
Well, it was pretty interesting during the last session. Last year when all the remarks were made with Perry and it made all the news, all of that was surrounding a piece of legislation very similar to the ones that have been going around many of the other state legislatures and have been passed, which are state sovereignty resolutions. And the one that was passed here, or the one that was working its way through the legislature here in Texas, was called HCR 50. And HCR 50 was a just pretty much a carbon copy of the state sovereignty, the memorial resolutions that were going through the other state legislatures. Before HCR 50 was introduced, we were aware of one, if not more, legislators that were actually going to introduce a secession referendum resolution during that session, but were dissuaded from doing so to let HCR 50 do its work first.
Okay. So let's say that you were able to get your referendum, and you were, before I ask you that, what's the overall feeling? How many people do you guys have on your side? What's the support you've got locally? Do you have enough people that you think if you got it to a referendum at this point that it would pass?
Yeah, I think at this point we are, if we can get this to a referendum, I feel very certain that we could get it to pass. Now, that's not to say that our job is done in this, as far as educating the people and getting people aware that this is a big issue and that they can actually express their opinion. But, when Rick Perry made his comments, there was this transformative moment. Prior to Rick Perry, and again, I joined up back in 1996. Prior to Rick Perry's statements, throughout that entire time, this idea of Texas independence was something that was talked about in people's living rooms and, back rooms of cafes, and, these were it was talked about in hush whispers. It was always kind of one of those things, hey, we can be a country again, but it was never really brought to the forefront. People were afraid to. But when the sitting governor got up and basically made the statement that, look, if Texas gets tired of federal government oppression, we may make the decision to leave, suddenly people felt a lot more free to express that opinion.
Right.
And that was pretty interesting to see that transformative moment happen, because there was a poll taken almost immediately after that. And it was done by Research 2000. It was commissioned by the Daily Kos, which you know how that goes.
Right.
But in this particular poll, we actually were able to grab the demographics for the poll. And as we compared the demographics and actually adjusted their demographics to actually match what the electorate is like here in Texas, one of the things that we found out is that we're not talking about thousands of people that support Texas independence. We're talking about millions of people that support Texas independence.
Oh, wow.
And with that kind of momentum going into a referendum, we have as good a shot of any to make this work, to win this vote. But we're not going to stop based on that one poll. We know sentiment has gradually continued to increase in our favor and in the favor of independence. And we're going to continue to do our job to get out there and educate people and inform people about why this is the right decision for Texas, and we're going to take this all the way to the referendum when we get it.
Okay. If you had to put a timeline on that, what would it be, the timeline to get the actual referendum?
Well, what we've done is we have an actual petition going right now. We've started a petition after the end of the last session. It's at lettexasdecide.com. Because we want to put political pressure. We want the people to put pressure on these legislators to give us this referendum. So it is our intention to take every one of the signatures and deliver them to the legislature on the first day of session on January the 11th, 2011. And we are fully expecting some movement out of the legislature on this issue. And I'm hoping that we will get a referendum at the time that they do the constitutional amendment elections next November.
Oh, wow. So aside from Rick Perry, are there any other elected officials in Texas that have voiced support or that actually do support the movement?
Well, you know, we have conversation with many of the legislators, you know, not just officially, but our members, our guys go out there, and our folks that are members of TNM are very politically astute, very aware, and very active. So they have individual interactions with them. I will tell you that we have had people that in the legislature that have voiced support for us, but as far as it goes publicly, I always say this: I will let them speak for themselves when they feel like they're going to get out there and speak about this issue and speak about the Texas Nationalist Movement, Texas Independence. Then I'll let them do that. I'm not going to out them. I will share a story with you, though. The last time that we were in Austin during the session, I testified, as a matter of fact, in the State Affairs Committee of the House over HCR 50. And it was interesting to note that while our members were walking through the halls of the Capitol wearing their Texas Nationalist Movement shirts, legislators and staffers were giving them high fives and treating them like rock stars. So that ought to tell you exactly what the sentiment is up there in the Capitol right now.
Wow, that's very interesting. Okay, so let's say you get the referendum next November and it passes. Can Texas survive on its own?
Oh, absolutely, beyond a shadow of a doubt. You know, Texas is one of the largest economies in the world, and the only thing that's kept us from growing is, frankly, the federal government. You know, we're sending almost $400 billion a year into the coffers of Washington, D.C., and, you know, regardless of the spin doctors over at MSNBC, we don't get even a fraction of that back, not nearly as much as we need. And, of course, with the federal government going the direction that it is, with excessive regulation, you know, things that are definitely not business-friendly, you know, having that barrier removed, we will continue to grow and to prosper and be one of the most prosperous economies in the world. You know, we can militarily defend ourselves. If you take the fact, when that's beside the fact that the average Texan owns 8 guns, you know, that's the only lament that we have down here is that we can't genetically engineer more arms to be able to use them all at once. But all jokes aside, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you take what our GDP is, or the equivalent GDP, and you apply the international standard of 4% of GDP for military spending, we would have one of the largest military budgets in the world, rivaling many of the other large nations in the world. So, you know, I think we'll be able to take care of ourselves, and I know for a fact we'll be able to take care of our border much better than Washington, D.C. has been able to.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Do you guys feel just like you've been abandoned by the federal government down there on the border?
Yeah, it really, honestly, is insulting. You know, when all of this started happening, Governor Perry has made many overtures toward the federal government, basically begging for assistance on the border. And it's become necessary because the federal government claims jurisdiction over border enforcement. And so, consequently, they try to tie the hands of the state or the county sheriffs or the police departments down there and basically say, hey, that's our job. You don't step on our toes. So what you find is, because they are derelict, and I want to tell you, the Border Patrol guys down there are doing the best job that they can, but they are just outmanned and outgunned, and that's a problem. And the federal government shows absolutely no signs of wanting to take care of it. So when all of these rumblings started happening about, you know, we're asking for more troops, we're asking for to deploy the National Guard down there to fix this issue, and, you know, we're met with silence with the Department of Homeland Security on that issue, they passed this, or they introduced this alien transfer and exit program where they announced suddenly they're going to start busing 35,000 deportees to Presidio, Texas every year and releasing them. And it's like, wait, could this get any more insulting? I mean, you know, we're asking for assistance, and now you're going to increase the illegal immigrant population in Presidio, Texas by 35,000 a year. This is unconscionable. So, you know, this is the kind of response that we're getting. It's not just now that they're derelict in their duties, they're sabotaging the border enforcement, the very limited border enforcement that we've got here in Texas already. So, you know, this is just, in our mind, just another reason that we need our independence so Texas can take care of its problems our way.
Yeah, the situation with Mexico is mind-boggling to me, the way the federal government's handled it over the last 10, 12, 15 years. It's just, it doesn't make any sense, you know. I'm all for free trade, but when it gets to the point where you've got American citizens' lives that are at stake, and Mexico is a complete failed state. I mean, it's failed down there. Anybody who thinks otherwise is kidding themselves. Are you guys confident that you could secure your border and that you wouldn't turn into just another small Mexico?
Well, there's no doubt that we could secure our border. You know, the challenge has been twofold here for us taking care, well, threefold actually, to us taking care of, being able to take care of our border. Number one is it comes down to money. And the fact of the matter is, with us sending, you know, Texas taxpayers sending so much money to Washington, D.C. for God only knows what, you know, to, you know, million here, million there to study cow flatulence in Idaho or whatever it is they do. You know, we can shift those resources and apply them to Texas needs. The second is manpower. You know, it would be fantastic if the governor could deploy the National Guard troops down on the border, but he has the bifurcated authority between the Department of Homeland Security and the state. Plus, you know, most of the National Guard units that could do anything are deployed overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan right now. So that's a huge issue for us. And then, of course, the third is the fact that the federal government continues to bicker over jurisdiction. Who has the job of border enforcement? So if you were to take the federal government out of the issue, if we weren't sending our money to D.C., we're sending our money to Austin, and we had our National Guard troops, our military-trained individuals here, there's absolutely no doubt whatsoever that we could secure that border between us and Mexico.
So you do know that if that referendum does pass, that you will have an influx of millions and millions of Americans moving to Texas, right?
Yeah, but, you know, that's the other thing, too. You know, if Texas were the only ones out there, that would be one thing. But, you know, there are currently sovereignty and or secession movements in over 30 states right now. So, you know, what we're seeing here is that there are other states that are wanting to go the same direction that Texas is going. So there's going to be plenty of spots for folks to go to. Besides Texas. Now, we welcome anyone who wants to come down here and fly that Lone Star flag and you know, espouse the principles of individual liberty and constitutional government. Come on down. You know, it's like the price is right. But, you know, my suggestion to a lot of these folks has been, and I say this, even though we have a large component of our membership that don't live in Texas, what I encourage people to do is get active in your state. You may think that you're the only one who believes this way, but you're not. And the fact of the matter is that you can band together with others and do exactly what we're doing here in Texas.
Just so all our listeners know, Mr. Miller, he knows all about ARFCOM. He knew who we were when we contacted him, and he was really excited to come on the show. I think he's a closet lurker, so he's one of us. So you know, Mr. Miller, we've got a lot of Texans on this website, that frequent the website. And it seems like not a week goes by that someone doesn't bring up a secession thread, a discussion thread, or someone doesn't say, if Texas seceded, would you move there? And I'm telling you, I don't think you understand. If a state is going to secede, the first one is going to be Texas. I just don't see any other state getting it done before you guys do. And
I hope that we're the first domino that falls.
if you do it first, I'm telling you, there's going to be millions of people packing up their families and moving to Texas. I can guarantee you 100%. Now, you spoke a little bit about there's these movements in other states. I know Alabama, I believe it was Alabama, just passed a law in January that a state sovereignty law. Has any of organizations from these other states contacted you guys and said, what about, you know, not just Texas being its own independent nation, but joining with a conglomeration of other states?
Well, and, you know, there has been talk about that. I mean, you have to understand that these independence movements are very widespread and very diverse. I mean, you know, one of the most active, amazingly enough, is the independence movement in Vermont. They are, you know, typically known as a left-leaning state. But what we find is that we share a lot of the principles of self-determination, and that's the key part here. But there are states that are very similar in mindset and as far as how they want to live and how they want to operate with a government that are very similar to Texas. And there is nothing that precludes us on the other side of this from forming some other type of union. You know, what we're talking about here really is not just some out-and-out secession and isolationism. What we're talking about here is a separation, you know, letting us choose how we want to govern ourselves and how we want to live. You know, these ideas of socialism or a very strong central government, those things may play well in New England. And if that's the case, let them have that in New England. But down here, let us determine how we want to live. We won't bash y'all over the head. You guys don't bash us over the head.
Right.
And we can live in peace together. So that really is the underlying principle here is self-determination. And there are other states. You know, Georgia was one. They I think, almost inadvertently passed a secession ordinance basically saying if you cross us on the Constitution, we're going to practice nullification up to and including secession. That's passed law in Georgia. Oklahoma and Arizona passed very similar laws years ago that if you trample on the Constitution and you violate the Tenth Amendment and our sovereignty, we reserve the right to leave. So, you know, these are principles that are not just brand new. It's always funny. Our membership director does a radio program on Monday nights, and he talks about his favorite analogy here is that this is nothing new. These issues, these frustrations are nothing new. This cake has been baking for a long time. The guys that are in Congress and the White House right now are just putting the icing and the candles on the cake. So this is why you're beginning to see a lot of this manifest, because when you light the candles, you get light. And now people are waking up and they're finding out exactly what type of situation we're in. You know, we're dealing, we are in a mess with, you know, for the border states, and not just the border states, but the border is a huge issue. The economy is a mess. We are in debt so far that my children's children's children will never be able to pay off the social engineering that's coming out of Washington, D.C. And now, you know, we're seeing this whole issue with cap and trade, you know, where they want to basically tax us for everything. I mean, it's basically equates to a hidden tax on everything that will drive the price up. And then we're seeing this assault on firearms ownership. And, you know, these things are unacceptable to us here in Texas. You know, that stuff may play well in Massachusetts, but down here in Texas, that's not what we want, and we won't stand for it.
You know, growing up, I think every kid who ever watched a John Wayne Western or just any Western always wanted to live at some point in Texas. I've only been there a couple of times, and I really loved it when I was down there. But we do a segment every week here called Get to Know, where we get one of the members of our website, and we just ask them a few questions. And one of the questions I ask is, if you could live anywhere other than where you live, where would you live? And the answer we get more than any other single answer is Texas. So there's this... there's this romance about the state of Texas, and there's a, you know, the mindset of the whole country is you know, Texas is, you know, I heard your media director's show a few weeks ago. It might have even been one of his first shows, and he said, if you've got a cowboy hat on and you go to another country, the first thing they ask is, are you from Texas? So, you know, you have this identity, you know, and my question is, you talked about the candles. These, when you light the candles, you get light. But when you light the candles, you also get fire. So if Texas, if you were to pass a referendum, especially with this administration, you know, what's to stop the entire might of the federal government just pounding on you and just crushing it before it? I mean, if Texas does secede from the union, or I know you don't want to call it secession, but if Texas passes that referendum, in essence, it would be removing itself from the union. There's going to be a war.
Well, and you know, that's a pretty typical response. You know, people believe, you know, because we have a history here where that's happened. You know, in the 1860s, you had an entire war on this soil that was based around that whole thing. But there are really two points here that I want to bring to the forefront, and that is, number one, this ain't the 1860s. The way that the federal government prosecuted war back in the 1860s is not how they do it now. You know, you're not basically dealing with state-centered militias or state-centered troops. I mean, you have people from you may be in a military unit. You may have two people in your unit from you know, your same state, but everybody else is going to be from some different place. So, you know, this is the constitution of the military is not like it was, and so consequently, you've got this issue where you have 1 in 10. Troops in the United States military that are from Texas. Okay,
so oh, then really? 10%.
Yeah, so you, yeah, 10% are from Texas, and then what you've got is a remaining half of those. In other words, so up to the next 50% are from states that are in essence doing some of the same things that Texas is regarding sovereignty or secession. Well, then you had this poll that came out recently. It was a few months back. Zogby did a poll of United States military about secession, and he polled active duty military service personnel, and he polled their families. And he asked them, do you support a state's right to secede? And in both categories, both active duty personnel and the families of active duty personnel, virtually half, right at half, if you take into account the margin of error, believed in a state's right to secede. So right now you've got this issue where you've got half of the United States military that believes that if a state leaves the Union, they are perfectly justified, constitutionally speaking, to do so, plus their family. So, you know, that, again, is the support network. But then you've got to deal with the federal government's ability to actually prosecute a war on its own soil. And I don't believe that they have the capability to do so, not when you've got military actions overseas that are so hot and heavy right now, plus you've got deployments that are all overseas. You know, most of the troops are spread out well all over the globe. Plus, I don't believe that the United States people, you know, the people even in the Northeast, are willing to watch bombed-out Walmarts in Houston, Texas on their nightly news. It's just not something that they're going to be willing to do. I don't think that they have the willpower and resolve to do it. So I think that when that side of it looks at it from that viewpoint, that there is an inability to do so and an unwillingness to do so, then I don't think they're going to be able to do it. Frankly, most of those states want to kick Texas out anyway. They don't like us, so what do we care?
You know, I would like to say I agree with you on that, but this administration scares me to death. And I have a feeling that they're going to do so much damage between now and the time that you get a chance for this referendum that your referendum will pass. I just know that they're going to do so much damage to just everybody in America that by the time this referendum comes up, Texans are going to be so fed up that it's going to pass overwhelmingly. But so if you don't think they're going to come down heavy-handed, what do you think this administration's reaction would be to Texas leaving the union?
Well, I think that they're probably, you know, and I'm being realistic here. Trust me, I'm not being facetious. I think that when the Obama administration, and particularly the Congress that is in there right now, looks at the prospect of having a union without Texas, I think, frankly, it makes them excited. You know, we see the overtures and the movements from them that, frankly, just tell us that they really don't care about what we're doing down here. It's enough for them to slam epithets at us and call us all kinds of names. But frankly, they really don't care. They feel that they would be much better off without us anyway.
Without the tax revenue?
Well, the tax revenue is going to be, I think, an issue. But there's nothing saying that the split cannot be amicable. And there's nothing saying that the separation couldn't take place over a given time period. But again, I believe that the federal government is in such a position right now, both economically, you know, financially, militarily, on every other front, that when Texas decides to leave, they won't be able to keep us. They just won't have that ability to do it. I mean, frankly, who's going to loan them money? Who's going to fight for them? Who's going to support that kind of activity? Although Obama likes to paint himself as the new Lincoln, the fact of the matter is that he doesn't have the resources that Lincoln had, and he doesn't have the willpower behind him, or he does not have the moral issue that Lincoln had, such as slavery, to be able to prosecute a war and get the people behind it.
Yeah, he's definitely not Lincoln, that's for sure. But he scares me. I would like to think, you know, that Texas could secede without a fight, but I don't know. But I do know that they definitely you're probably right in the fact that they do not want to fight an insurgency of the type that Texas would bring to them. There's probably some truth to that. I wish you luck. Now, one question I wanted to ask before we get off here, we've only got a couple more minutes. Are you worried that you will be branded as a seditionist, or there will be charges brought up on you for what you guys are trying to do? Has any federal government agencies contacted you and said tone down the rhetoric or anything like that?
No, they never tell us to tone down the rhetoric. And I'll tell you this, I get that question often. You know, they love to sling that we're a bunch of, you know, we're committing treason and things like that. I will tell you this, that if the federal government were to come to me and try to level a charge of treason or sedition against me, I will immediately go turn myself in, and I will feel more than happy, be more than happy to go to court and hand them their butt, because that is a fight they cannot win. They couldn't win it with Jefferson Davis, and they're sure as hell not going to win it with me.
You know, you're just an interesting guest. His name is Daniel Miller. He's the president of the Texas Nationalist Movement. Check out their website. If you get a chance, you're just surfing the net tonight. It's texasnationalist.com. There's a lot of interesting information there. They've got their own radio show over on Blog Talk Radio. They do each week. And I really want to thank you for taking some time out, Daniel. I know you're busy, and we're not the biggest radio show in the world, but I really appreciate you coming on and letting ARFCOM know what you guys are really all about, and that, you know, for everybody that says, no, Texas will never leave, Texas will never leave, I don't know if the naysayers are right. I think, especially with this administration that we have now, that if the referendum comes up, I think Texas is out of here.
Well, John, I tell you, I do appreciate it. Thank you for having me on. I love what you're doing and can't wait to stay in touch and hopefully come over and do the show again.
Yeah, we'll definitely have you back on, especially after the gubernatorial elections down there in Texas later on this year, and kind of how that would maybe change things for you guys and get an update on how you guys are doing.
Sounds like a plan. Thank you so much.
Thanks again. Daniel Miller, president of the Texas Nationalist Movement. That's all the time we have for tonight, everybody. Before we go, I want to remind everybody, next week, and this is just for my listeners, I'm not going to post this up on the website, and I would appreciate it if no one else would post this up. We have I will post up that we're having representatives from Bushmaster and Magpul come on the show and talk about the ACR. They are bringing a ton of stuff to give away, including a Bushmaster M4 complete rifle. You heard me right. They're going to give away a complete rifle on the show next week. We probably won't actually give it away on the show, but we'll do it. We'll do a drawing in the Bushmaster form, and it's just for the listeners. I'm not going to put it out there for everybody else who doesn't listen. It's just for you guys. You have something really cool to look forward to next week. Bushmaster and Magpul both going to be on, both giving away goodies, and Bushmaster really stepped up to the plate to give away a complete M4 rifle, civilian version, of course. So you have that to look forward to. I want to thank Seth, our producer, for making the show run as smooth as it can run, just like butter. I want to thank Merrill. He runs the discussion threads, puts up all the links for us, keeps everybody up to date on what we're doing. I want to thank the Avilas and AR15.com for letting us stay on there, keeping this show rolling. Joe DeBurgles, as always, for being on the show. Jarhead22. We also had Matt Sharp from the NRA Firearms Museum. It's just been a great show, and I'm really excited about where we're going in the future here. Don't forget next week, all things ACR. On the way out, I just want to say God bless America.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache.